congregation here. I want to thank the elders here for planning this weekend, providing the opportunity. It has been a joy to get to meet so many of you for the first time and to start building relationships with you. Thank you so much for that opportunity. I want to thank the group here for the work that they're doing and the fact that we had the meeting in the first place. I think I mentioned on Thursday, this is the first meeting I've held since February. And I've had two or three canceled and postponed, and who knows when those are going to happen. So thank you for following through and making sure that this took place and providing it for those who still aren't able to come out. Thank you for the work that you're doing with that. We have two lessons left, this one and then this evening. So let's try to end on a really good note. How about we talk about Jesus this morning and this evening? Let's talk about Jesus this morning on the night that he was betrayed. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the Garden of Gethsemane and some lessons that we can take from Jesus and his prayer there and the nature of submission. We want to talk about the nature of submission. We know that prayer took place in the garden, and the garden was on the Mount of Olives. And so we'll try to set the context for our lesson this morning. Let's talk about geography a little bit. So this is a satellite view of Jerusalem. You see the very well-known Temple Mount with the Golden Dome there. And then between the Temple Mount and what is called the Church of All Nations runs the Kidron Valley from north to south. And that's going to be significant as we get to the conclusion of the lesson. As you continue heading east, you come to the Mount of Olives. And the Mount of Olives is approximately 2,700 feet tall. It is the tallest peak in Jerusalem. So if you are standing at the observation platform, the observation parking lot at the top of the mountain, looking toward Jerusalem, you see the whole thing. Obviously, the buildings get in the way after a certain point, but it's one of the best vantage points to see the city of Jerusalem. It's just beautiful. We mentioned the Kidron Valley, and we want to mention that the distance from the Mount of Olives to the old city is about 2.2 miles. So when it talks about Herod's palace, when it talks about Caiaphas's palace, when it talks about where Jesus would have done a lot of his teaching, you're talking about approximately 2 miles from that point to the Mount of Olives. Now, Jesus, in the traditional location of the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus would have gone to a spot that was not at the peak. The traditional location of the Mount of Olives is actually toward the foothill of the mountain, so it wouldn't have quite have been that far. So what we'd like to do is to play a short clip of the Mount of Olives and the Garden of Gethsemane.
Jeremy, we've come to the Church of All Nations, which sits on the traditional site of the Garden of Gethsemane on the eastern side of Jerusalem.
Now, obviously, it's closed. It's dark. We're not going to be able to get in. And it looks a lot different than it would have when Jesus was here. We've got modern city streets, cars, lights. But if we can imagine what that would have been like after Jesus' final Passover meal with the disciples, they have sung their songs. Jesus has prayed for them, as recorded over in John. And then they come up here for Jesus to pray multiple times. What's one of the reasons that coming out at night is so important, especially looking back to Jerusalem?
Well, understanding that when Jesus and his disciples were here, it would have been dark. They didn't have the light that we have today. They would have been able to see the walls of Jerusalem, and they would have been able to see the gates. And John tells us about the army coming out with their lanterns and torches and weapons. Jesus would have been able to see that from here.
Now, that's really heightened by this dark atmosphere. It's going to be great to get in there and see what that looked like.
We'll do that tomorrow.
Jesus had the reputation of going to that spot, to that garden, to pray. And he knew what was happening that night. During the Passover meal, he actually sent Judas out to do what he was going to do. For anybody else, if they knew what was going on, they would have gone to an alternate spot. They would have gone to a spot that was different than the routine to be safe and to keep himself from harm. But Jesus didn't vary his routine. He still went through with where he normally went, knowing that that's where Judas would find him. I I was a little disappointed we couldn't get into the Garden of Gethsemane at night. I understand why, but it's exciting to go back.
Yeah, they had a special prayer service going on. Being there in the daytime, we'll have even a better perspective. We'll be able to see things even clearer than we did last night.
It's such an emotional place. I mean, Jesus was so vulnerable when he was in the garden praying the night that he was arrested. I don't even know how to anticipate what that's going to be like to be there.
Jeremy, we've entered the courtyard of the Church of All Nations, which sits on the traditional location of the Garden of Gethsemane. This building was built in the 1920s, and it was built on top of the foundations of a 4th century Byzantine chapel and a 12th century Crusader basilica. In the 1st century, there was an oil press here. Of course, in Aramaic, the word Gethsemane means oil press. During the time of Jesus, this would have been the area where they would have crushed all of the olives that come from the olive trees from what we know as the Mount of Olives.
There are some cultural ideas about the various numbers of olive pressings. You'd put the olives in, you'd press it, and the first pressing went to this, and the second pressing went to this, and the third pressing would be used for this. And so the fact that Jesus was in an area known for its olive press, and that he prays and pours himself out under intense pressure 3 different times, is very significant.
This was a place where he was known to go to for just some solitude. And so this is a place where on the night he was betrayed, he felt it was a good place for him to go and talk to his father. And he carried some of the disciples there with him.
To be able to walk into a grove of olive trees, especially one as old as the one that we went to, is really special.
That whole area is really only about the size of half of a football field. If the church building or the olive trees aren't sitting in the exact location, it's very close.
Jesus prayed all through his life. Prayer was something special for him. He set aside time to make sure to communicate with the Father. This night was especially significant for him. It's just before his betrayal. It's just before his arrest. He comes here to pray 3 times to ask God if there's any way possible that he could avoid the cross and everything that went along with the cross. The Gospels tell us that Jesus prayed, that he had a habit of praying, that he would go off by himself to pray. But it's not very often that the Gospels give us the words of his prayers. And so to have those words on the eve of such a momentous day is really, really special. And then to understand that it was several times that he offered a very similar prayer. That's how intent he was on it. And the answer was given to him with the light of the torches coming down. The answer was no, this is the way. And he submitted himself to God's will.
I hope that was helpful. I'll give you some more details about what you're looking at right there. But if you were at the Temple Mount looking back across the Kidron Valley toward the Mount of Olives, you'd see the western slope. The majority of that slope, all of those white stones that you see, that is actually a graveyard. That's a cemetery. And all of those are headstones and burial places. At the peak, you have the parking lot. And then most people take a small walking path north, which would be to your left. The Church of All Nations sits a little bit past the trees that you see there. And the Church of All Nations was actually in the news. I don't think there's any audio with this. The Church of All Nations was in the news this week. Someone actually went over to the building and tried to set it on fire. They were able to stop them. This is the entrance into the traditional location of the garden. Some of those same shots that you saw. It's incredibly beautiful. And some of those trees have been dated to over 1,500 years old. So not that those trees would have necessarily have been there during the life of Christ, but they very well could be connected to the trees that were there during the life of Christ. Some of them are much younger than that. The church itself, the Church of All Nations, as Barry mentioned, it was constructed in the early 1900s, and nations from all over the world donated to put that building there, which is why it's called the Church of All Nations. Sits on the ruins of a 4th century Byzantine basilica and also a 12th century Crusader chapel. And the centerpiece that you saw on the inside, up toward the front, was this exposed bedrock. And that exposed bedrock is what they call the Rock of Agony. They believe that that is the traditional spot that Jesus actually knelt down and prayed. And so when you're there and tour groups are coming through, they're all going up and they're trying to get close enough to touch it, to kiss it, to place items that they want blessed on the stone. You'll see that all over the place in the land of Israel. There is no way on earth to prove that that is the exact spot that Jesus knelt and prayed. But to know that there is an ancient olive grove at the foothill of the Mount of Olives matches the description of the location that Jesus went to. So it's rooted in reality. We don't have to know the exact spot. I snuck a picture of some folks as they were trying to almost worship the rock. But I hope it stood out to you as we talked about some of the details about Jesus and his habit of prayer. One of the things that we mentioned was we have such a long record of Jesus praying, but we don't always have the details of his prayer. We don't always have the words of his prayer. So the fact that the gospel writers, by inspiration, gave us the words of his prayer, that's significant. And that's special. We need to pay attention to that. And what we see in Jesus' prayer in the garden is we see this struggle between his desire and what God's will is, which is also something really unique to watch between the Father and the Son, and to see it with such intensity. And so what I'd like to do for the rest of our time this morning as we talk about Jesus in the garden is I'd like us to talk about submission. What does Jesus' time in the garden teach us about submission? And the first point might be kind of obvious, but I think it's this: that times of distress should not be the only time that we pray. Times of distress should not be the only time that we pray. In Luke chapter 22 and verse 39, Luke says that Jesus came out and went, as was his custom, to the Mount of Olives, and the disciples followed him. He had a custom of going to that garden. Specifically, he had a custom of praying. Jesus prayed all through the course of his life. And to make that point, I really quickly want to rattle down through a list of passages exclusive to Luke's gospel. So this does not include Matthew, Mark, or John. But I just want you to notice how often Luke records the fact that Jesus prayed. Luke chapter 5, verses 15 and 16. Jesus withdrew to a desolate place to pray. Luke chapter 9, verse 16. He blessed the loaves and the fishes before feeding the 5,000. Luke chapter 9, 18 through 22. He was praying alone just before he asked the disciples who they thought he was. Luke 9, 28 through 29. He was praying with three disciples as the transfiguration happened. Luke chapter 10, verse 2. He told the disciples to pray for laborers. In Luke 10, 21 through 22, he offered a prayer of thanks. Luke 11, 1 through 14, he taught his disciples how to pray. Luke 18, 1 through 8, he taught the disciples to be persistent in prayer. Luke 19, 45 through 46, Jesus described the temple as a house of prayer. Luke 20, 45 through 47, Jesus condemned pretentious prayer. Luke 22, 31 through 34, Satan sought all of the disciples, but Jesus had already prayed for them. And then, in Luke chapter 23, do you realize that the last thing that Jesus said before he died was a prayer? Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. He prayed. And I realized that was like rapid fire, shotgun style. And that's the point. Jesus talked to God all the time about all sorts of things. It was not Jesus' habit to only talk to God when he was hurting and struggling and weak. Actually, there's one that's really special, and I skipped over it because I want to go back and I want to read it and challenge you a little bit. Go over to Luke chapter 9. Luke chapter 9, starting in verse 28. I'm sorry, Luke 6. Go back three more chapters. Luke 6. Luke 6 and starting in verse 12. It says, in these days, he, being Jesus, went out to the mountain to pray. And all night he continued in prayer to God. And when day came, he called his disciples and chose from them 12 whom he named apostles. Simon, whom he named Peter, Andrew, his brother, James and John, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, James, Simon, who was called the Zealot, and Judas, the son of James, Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. Judas is identified all the way back here. Look at verses 12 and 13. In these days he went out to the mountain to pray, and all night he continued in prayer to God. And when day came, he called the disciples and chose from them 12. Jesus, the night before he appoints the 12, prays. He prays all night. And we know from other parts of the gospel, there are times where Jesus specifically prays for those men. What was he praying about? All night. We don't know. The text doesn't state what he prayed about all night. I'm gonna throw out the Jeremy thinks so of this, and we can talk about it more later. I do not think Jesus was asking God to show him who to choose. I think Jesus already knew who he was going to appoint. I think he already did. But just like over in John, and just like we mentioned, Jesus had already prayed for them that Satan wouldn't sift them, I think Jesus spent all night praying for the man he had already chosen. He knew what they would be doing in their ministry. He knew what Satan would want to accomplish and try to pull them away. He knew the trials that they would face, the temptations that they would face. And Jesus spent all night praying for those men before he appointed them. This is just the Jeremy thinks so, but that's impressive and instructive. When was the last night you stayed up all night praying for somebody? As you appoint elders and deacons, how much time do you put into prayer? As preachers move from place to place, how much time do congregations and evangelists put into prayer about that process? As you go to make big decisions about life, how much time do you invest in prayer, talking with God about it? I love those two verses and what they seem to teach. So getting back to Jesus and his prayer in the garden, that prayer in the garden was not an anomaly. It was a part of his daily life with the Father. Jesus prayed all the time. But there's something unique about his time in the garden, and that's the fact that he took some men with him. Jesus was wrestling with submitting to what God wanted him to do. And so he took three men, three trusted men, the same three that were at the Mount of Transfiguration. He takes those three men with him, and he's asking them to help him and assist him. Let's look at some passages. Mark chapter 14, starting with verse 34. He said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here." He wants them with him. "Remain here and watch." He came and found them sleeping, and he said to Peter, "Simon, are you asleep? Could you not watch 1 hour?" Watch what? To be awake and alert and with Jesus in his distress. Watch. Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. They kept falling asleep. It is entirely appropriate that when we're wrestling, when we are struggling, where God has instructed us and called us to a specific course, and we're struggling with that, it is so appropriate to reach out to our spiritual siblings and ask them to help. To be honest and open and let them know that we're struggling, and ask them to watch with us and to be with us. And to pray with us. We need to seek the assistance of God's people when we're struggling with submission. And we see Jesus doing that. The third thing that I think we see in the prayer is this, that it's entirely appropriate to humbly and zealously ask God to change his mind. Because that's what Jesus was doing. So let's look at Matthew. Turn over to Matthew chapter 26. Matthew 26. And let's go to verse 36. And let's read the prayer. Starting in verse 36. Then Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane. And he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." And taking with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. And then he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me." And going a little farther, he fell on his face and prayed, saying, "My Father, "If it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." And he came to the disciples and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, "So could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." Again, for the second time, he went away and prayed, "My Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done." And again, he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. So leaving them again, he went away and prayed for the third time, saying the same words again. Then he came to the disciples and said to them, "Sleep and take your rest later on. See, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." The prayers all seem to hinge on this phrase regarding the cup, where Jesus has a different desire regarding the cup than God has regarding the cup. And just for a moment, let's talk about this idea of the cup. And I think we need to understand what Jesus' concept of the phrase, the cup, was. Because his understanding would have been influenced by its use in the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, the image of a cup being drunk or a cup being poured out, it was an image of someone receiving the just judgment of God for their rebellion and wickedness. Let's just look at a couple. In Psalm 11, verse 6, the psalmist says, "Let him rain coals on the wicked, fire and sulfur and a scorching wind shall be the portion of their cup." The psalmist is praying that God would pour out judgment on the wicked. And that judgment is described as something being poured out of a cup. Psalm 75 and verse 8, the psalmist says, "In the hand of the Lord there is a cup with foaming wine, well mixed, and he pours out from it, and all the wicked of the earth shall drain it down to the dregs." Like, this is a gross drink, and God is going to make the wicked people drink every little bit of it. Isaiah 51 and verse 17, "Wake yourself, wake yourself. Stand up, O Jerusalem, you who have drunk from the hand of the Lord the cup of his wrath, who have drunk to the dregs the bowl, the cup of staggering." One more in Jeremiah 25, verses 15 through 17. "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, said to me, take from my hand this cup of the wine of wrath, and make all the nations to whom I send you drink it. They shall drink and stagger and be crazed because of the sword that I'm sending among them. So I took the cup from the Lord's hand and made all the nations to whom the Lord sent me to drink it." There are more than that. That's just four. But I think what we see here is this concept of the cup seems to be describing wrath and judgment from God on wickedness and sin. So we need to think about what's going on here. We understand from passages like 1 Peter 2:22, Hebrews 4:15, 1 John 3:5, Jesus was sinless. He did not deserve any amount of God's wrath. None. So we can conclude that in the crucifixion, what Jesus was about to face, starting with the betrayal and the arrest, all of the trials leading up to the crucifixion, everything that he was about to face, he was about to experience the just wrath of God that was due for sin, even though he didn't deserve it. And he's asking God, if there is any way to fulfill your will without having to go through the next 24 hours, can we please go that way? That seems like a request I might make. And I want you to think about the language that's used to describe the prayers. Think about the language that he used. He was troubled. His soul was very sorrowful, even to death. He was in agony, according to Luke 22:44. That's not all. Think about the posture that he took. Going a little farther, he fell on the ground. Luke 22, he knelt down. I mean, he is just prostrating himself before God. And think about in one gospel, Luke chapter 22, it shouldn't surprise us that it's in the physician's gospel, But think about the severe physical reaction that he had during this process. He prayed more earnestly, and his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. He was so intent and so intense in his prayer to God that the capillaries within his sweat glands began rupturing. Just as an aside, that process would have made his skin even more tender as he went into the arrests and the mocking and the scourging. The point is this. It's appropriate. It can be appropriate to humbly and zealously ask God to change his mind. That's okay, because Jesus did it. But this is the thing with submission. You have to be willing to accept the answer. It's okay to make the request. But God ended up saying no. And that leads us into our fourth point. When God answers, we need to calmly and reverently submit. When God answers, we need to calmly and reverently submit. Jesus asked that this cup of wrath be taken away from him. And that was not going to happen. What the text actually says, we don't have some big boom. We don't see a theophany, an appearing of God. We don't see lightning strike. We don't see smoke. We don't see fire. We don't see any of those things. Jesus prays three times. But then, as it wraps up, he talks to the three and says, "Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." And this really stood out to me after going to the garden for the first time in 2015. Because as you stand at the location of the traditional location of the garden and look back west toward the city, you see down into the Kidron Valley and back up and you see the Temple Mount. And if that general area is where Jesus was in the garden in the first century, and it's dark, what John explains for us in John chapter 18 and verse 3 is that the crowd that came to arrest him had lanterns and torches. What do you think he saw coming down from the Temple Mount area as they came out of the gate at night? He would have seen them come down the side of the Kidron Valley and start working their way back up. He could see them. And I want you to think about the significance of that. Jesus didn't want to go. And you think about other places in the Gospels, especially earlier in his ministry. There's one incident that I'm thinking of specifically where he's in Nazareth and the villagers are all upset with Jesus and they grab him and they take him outside of the city and they're going to throw him down to kill him. This huge mob, this crowd around Jesus. And it says Jesus just walked right through them. Because it was not yet his time. And so it's not like Jesus hasn't encountered crowds and mobs and angry people before. He has. And he's walked away and he's been fine. But that night, as he's praying to avoid this, if there's any other way to accomplish God's will, he's praying, he's zealous, he's burst the capillaries, but he sees the torches coming. He has time to run away if he wants. He has time to go. But instead, he calmly stands up because God has given him an answer. And he tells his apostles to stand up. And he stands there and waits for them to come and arrest him. That's the heart of submission. Someone said this to me and it's just stuck with me. Understanding submission, submission is not agreement. Agreement is agreement. Submission is when you don't necessarily agree, but you submit anyway. I've met people that say, "Oh, I submit all the time." No, you don't. You go along with things because you agree with it. When you don't agree, you go and do your own thing. Submission is when your heart and your desire are in a different place, but you choose to lower yourself before the person who has authority and you do what you've been called to do. And Jesus is such a beautiful, powerful example of submission. So great. Think about times in your life where you've wrestled with that and you've wrestled with submission. Do you realize Jesus is our perfect example in everything, even in this? Jesus wrestled with submission, but he did it. And he did it well, and he did it perfectly. So there will be times in your life where you are struggling to do what God has called you to do, to put your faith and your trust in him and accept what he has said. All of us, we're going to have those times throughout the course of our life. But we need to keep coming back to the garden and looking at Jesus' example here, where we can go to God and we can pour ourselves out before him. We can be zealous. We can be intense. We need to be reverent. He was respectful. We see that with the psalmists as well. You see the psalmists wrestle through really heavy things. Asaph over in Psalm 73. But they go to God. They pray to God. They pour themselves out before God. They're reverent and they're respectful. They're passionate and they're zealous. But at the end, whatever God says, that's where I'm going to go. And I may not understand it, and I may not like it, but out of my love for him and in order to please him, I'm going to submit. I'll tell you, it's so much easier to do when you understand the nature of God and how good he is. Because God doesn't call us to hard and difficult things just to see us struggle. God is for us, and he works all things for our good, according to Romans 8:28 and 29. So it makes it easier to place my trust in God and submit to God when I understand who he is and what he's like. And what such a great example in Jesus. There's more that we could say, but I'm going to leave it at that because I want to say it tonight. Okay, we're going to come back to this same 24-hour period and talk about Christ and his crucifixion tonight. So let's wrap up the lesson this way. I don't know all of you very well. I only know a couple of you and just for a few days. So I don't know your circumstances. I don't know where you are in your walk as a disciple. I don't know what you're struggling with. But if there's some area of your life that you're wrestling with submitting to God, can I just ask you to please reread Jesus' prayer in the garden and follow his example. Pour yourself out, wrestle with God, be reverent, but when the time comes to stand up from the prayer, submit. Follow the example of Jesus and put God first. And when you're struggling with that, will you please, please, please let other siblings, spiritual siblings in your life know, because God does not intend for you to do that alone. Reach out to the elders, reach out to the deacons. If you're married to a Christian, reach out to your Christian spouse. There are spiritual siblings and we're supposed to be helping each other with this. Follow Jesus' example with that. Let other people know so they can assist you. And if you've struggled with that and failed in that and you want prayers and encouragement, let us know by coming to the front while we stand and while we sing. Either